What are your vegetables? Who are your vegetables?
I did. They're good, and you're going to eat them.
So, are we going to talk about it?
What?
The elephant in the room.
What elephant?
I guess not, then.
What are you talking about, Anders?
Oh, I don't know. Dad's podcast. Why aren't we on it?
Well, I mean, you were busy wrapping up school. I figured you wouldn't have time to do it.
You never even asked us. We want to record podcasts.
You guys are a little young to be on the podcast so much.
It's defined who I am.
We're not saying you can't. What?
Someone in the movie said it.
Look, we were recording late, and I knew you'd be in bed.
Do you record live?
Well, no.
And you want us to keep doing these?
Sure, but I...
Then it's settled. I have to succeed so we can succeed. So we can succeed.
Okay, now you're just quoting the movie.
Behold, the Underminer.
How many times did you take them to see this movie?
Honestly, I don't even remember. Okay, what if I let you do the intro?
Great. Suit up. It might get weird.
Welcome to the conversation.
Welcome to Screenfish.
Welcome to Screenfish Radio. We are so glad you could join us as this week we talk about Incredibles 2. After a 14-year hiatus, the Parr family is back, and they have the opportunity to try and bring superheroes back into the limelight, putting the focus on Elastigirl, trying to get some good press so that they can get the government to reverse their decision to ban superheroes. For this week, we are thrilled to have back Alan Scherer. Welcome back, Alan.
Nice to be back.
And Screenfisher and podcast newbie Heather Johnson. Welcome, Heather.
Hello. Excited to be here.
We are so glad to have you guys here tonight. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Guys, can I say that with a level of gender acceptance? I don't know if I can say that term. No.
I mean, I'm from the South. I don't really... I'm fine with it.
Excellent.
I don't care. I'm being from the South, too. Yeah.
You can just say y'all.
Okay. What did y'all think of Incredibles 2?
I really enjoyed it. You know, I didn't have a very strong frame of reference for this movie. I had seen the first one years ago and had kind of just written it off as, you know, oh, one of those Pixar movies. So I didn't necessarily come into it with like the eagerness and excitement of everybody, but I had just rewatched it not even a week before it came out. And my kids were just so hooked on it, and it really just kind of encouraged me to get out there and see it. And I was really, really not so much pleasantly surprised, but I guess pleasantly surprised. It was a fantastic movie. I mean, I was riveted. I was laughing out loud. I was telling my kids to be quiet so that I could hear it. So it was a great movie.
I personally thought the film was a nice addition to the Incredibles genre, I would guess. It was about the same as the first. There were some similarities that you saw from the first film to the second in plot structure and, you know, things like that. But then again, my kids were riveted. They were laughing at the right times. They were just glued to the screen. And, of course, the particular theater we saw it in, the entire audience burst into rapturous applause at the end, which I rarely ever experience in a movie theater. But yeah, I love the fact that there were new characters, new superheroes with unique powers that they were able to still work with. And so it seems like it's its own kind of universe, almost like the Marvel Universe or the DC Universe. This could take on a real life of its own.
I couldn't believe that we waited 14 years for a sequel to the one Pixar film that desperately needed a sequel. Since this one came out, we got a sequel to Cars, a prequel to Monsters, Inc., actually two sequels to Cars, and Finding Nemo. And the one film that they came out with that basically made you scream for a second one, and that's the one we had to wait 14 years to get. It always amazes me.
So, Steve, to kind of reverse, you know, the question onto you, what was so important about this sequel, you know, or what was it that had you waiting for it, and did it meet your expectations?
Oh, man, it's nobody asks me questions. gosh golly. you know what?
Say gosh golly.
I said it. I said it, and I don't regret it.
I do.
Touche.
No,
in all honesty, in terms of the films they had, I felt like it was the one that wasn't an entirely enclosed story. You look at the early Pixar films, and almost all of them are an enclosed story. You know, so a film like Finding Nemo is not designed to tell you the next chapter. Like, it is clearly about the maturation of one child and his relationship with his father. And sort of it comes to this climactic point after the death of his mother and all this sort of, you know, how that all sort of plays together. And I liked Finding Dory, but I didn't sit there saying what happens next. Monsters, Inc., you could make that argument, but I actually even liked Monsters University. There have been some I haven't liked from Pixar, but I liked it. But I didn't sit there and say, I really wish I knew how they met. Like, I didn't ask the questions. With the way that The Incredibles was set up all those years ago, when it ends, it's probably the only one that ends on a literal note that says the story's going to continue. You know?
That literal cliffhanger.
Yeah.
That you see probably more in TV or in movies that have come from, like, series of books, or you know that there's something coming, so they can kind of leave it that way, whereas with The Incredibles, they just boldly went there and just left it.
Yeah, and now, I mean, the way that they did it, it's not like they didn't wrap up their story. So, but it was very clearly done that way to show you that, hey, their adventures are going to continue. And I actually really appreciated the fact that they continued from that point. So it was, you know, with animation, mm-hmm. they can say, you know, 10 years later. But I think that's why when I came out of that one, I was just like, all right, let's pop in the next one. You know, I had the same sort of experience when I saw Batman Begins all those years ago, because they sort of divvy the tease of the Joker card. And I remember looking over, I said, okay, is the next one coming on right now? Like, can we just keep watching? And that's how I felt after The Incredibles. You know, people say, did it meet my expectations, you asked. And it did, and it didn't. I know I've heard some people say to me, this is the best. Well, even Jacob has said it on, you know, this is one of the best superhero sequels he's ever seen. And I've heard multiple people say that. It is a solid film, or it delivers what you wanted, and it gives you the family. It gives you a lot of the superhero action, and tries to balance the two things. I really appreciated that. I've seen it twice now, and I'm still trying to figure out how much I liked it. I liked it, but I feel like other people are enjoying it more than I did, and it's been difficult for me to track why.
Well, I think part of the reason why people have enjoyed it so much is maybe because of that 14-year gap. You're sharing it with a new generation of individuals. My kids, for example, had never seen the original Incredibles. I had to actually go get the DVD, plop it in, and that's how they were able to pick up from it. But if they had watched it, you know, stone cold in the theater, they would have gotten just as much out of it, and they probably would have been saying, all right, Dad, we want to see the DVD of the first one now.
Maybe. I feel like the first one had slightly better character development, but I could be wrong. Actually, you know what? I can't even say that, because they had great character development with Mr. Incredible and Elastigirl in this one. There were just a couple of things I felt like were thrown in. Like, Edna was thrown in, you know, which is great. I like Edna. It's fine. And it was fine having her in there. I'm not hating on the film when I say those things. I felt like the kids were a little bit meandering in their story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Violet storyline in this film kind of bugged me. A little bit less the second time I saw it. The first time she kind of grated on me. But it just, like, it felt like they wanted to do more with the kids, but they didn't have much time, or they, I felt like they really needed to do a third one and just focus in on the kids and their relationship with the parents, as opposed to the marriage aspect, which they've done in the two films. But it was great. Like, it was really well done, but, you know, I didn't sit there waving the flag of it's a 10 out of 10 for me. But I, you know, there's the question, guys, is one of the things that I was thinking of is, What is it about this family that keeps drawing us back to them? Because this movie is making a killing. It's the highest, our highest grossing animated film opening of all time, and it's climbing the ladder. Why do we care so much about the Parr family?
Well, I think, and this is coming from, you know, somebody who didn't necessarily have a super vested interest in this sequel, but going back and watching the first one and seeing the second one, you know, closer together, is for, you know, for animated superhero family, they are awfully relatable. Our home life is similar. Not that we have magic, you know, superpowers, but I work full time and my husband is the stay-at-home dad to our kids. And that's not something you see portrayed very often in entertainment. Mm. And even after being in these roles, this kind of switch for the past 6 years, there are still new elements. You know, each child is different. Each circumstance requires a different kind of trade-off or in the partnership, and people have to step up and let somebody else kind of step back. And I think that is such an authentic example of marriage, at least for me while I was watching this. I was also sitting there with three kids in a theater full of kids, but the pieces that I was able to focus on that I just found myself gravitating to was, oh my gosh, my husband and I have had that conversation of going back to work and who's going to stay with the kids. Oh my goodness, I've been the mom that can't learn the math because math has changed. And so there are these nuggets of reality in it that I just don't feel like, especially in an animated film. And if you look at Disney, there's always this level of magic and theatrical that is what makes Disney so special. But here, there's that balance between what makes the Parrs special and what makes them relatable and, you know, for lack of a better word, normal. And I think that balance is something that is so well done. That's why people are coming back for more for the Parr family.
Hmm. Now, to piggyback on that, I think you're very much on the right track with a lot of that. I mean, this in a lot of ways is my family. For the good and for the bad. We sometimes, you know, we struggle. We get upset with each other. And yet we've learned how to, you know, forgive each other. We, you know, we move on. We show our kids, you know, we love them and we care about them. And yet at the same time, we help them in their, you know, respective, you know, situations. And yet each of the kids is unique and each of the kids is different too. They have their pluses, they have their minuses, and yet at the end of the day, they all can say, you know, we're our family, we take care of each other, we will make it through regardless of the events of the day that hit us.
So, Alan, what are the downsides of your family? Why don't you go into those in great detail?
Do you really want me to go there?
How many kids do you have?
Three.
I have a
16-year-old, which completely relates to Violet. I have a 9-year-old, which is pretty much Dash. And then I have a 6-year-old that we haven't figured out quite yet.
So they're Jack-Jack.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what I'm saying, you know. I mean, I keep thinking back to the first film, you know, there was a lot of tension there between the family members, and it was about, you know, syndrome. But yeah, you see all those struggles that resulted as a result of Syndrome and his assistant, you know, and Helen thinking that Bob is, you know, looking for someone else, and there's some miscommunication, and no, none of this has happened here, but you do see that in marriages and relationships all the time, where there's a lot of mistrust and there's a lot of struggling that doesn't necessarily manifest itself out in the open, but when it does, it can be quite explosive.
You know, when Incredibles came out, the thing that struck everybody was that they made an animated film about a midlife crisis and a superhero. And this one, it's astounding how timing works. Now, I realize that there have been multiple films about female leads in the works over the past few years. But, I mean, coming out of a Me Too culture, the timing of this at this point is huge. And I know that there's been, you know, like a film like Last Jedi or Wonder Woman, they were in production a long time. Like, they're in production a couple of years. And but for this one, which has been in production for about 3 or 4 years now, to come out at this time is unbelievably, well, timely. And the but the focus is always on the relationships, which I really appreciate. You get to see the bit of dynamics in the home. And I agree, you know, that's one of the things I really love about this particular family. What did y'all think of...
Okay, turning into a Southerner yet?
No, I'm from Toronto. It's not going to sound right coming out of my mouth.
Would you like some sweet tea?
I don't even know what that is, eh? I don't know what you're talking about. Oh, I hate myself for saying that because I don't say a boot. But anyway...
You just did.
I did.
You perpetuated your own stereotype.
I did. I perpetuated my own stereotype. Speaking of stereotypes...
Don't take it out of the podcast.
I won't. I would really like to know what you guys thought of the way the way that gender roles and gender dynamics are portrayed in this particular film. Because it's a really interesting flip, again, compared to the first film. But they change up a lot. I mean, Heather was saying, you've got the man at home, the woman at work, which is not typical work, of course, but unless Heather likes to stop freight trains, which she might. I mean, we're just getting to know her.
I mean, unless they're like Thomas-sized on a track that is going in between the hallway, that's the most train stopping that I do on a daily basis. They're just as dangerous. You step on one of those suckers, it's as bad as a Lego because little wheels are turning and it pinches your skin. It's miserable.
Well, there you go. You're practically Elastigirl anyway, so you relate.
Practically
a superhero. Yeah, that's incredible. That's incredible. Ah, dang it. That's no pun intended again.
Well, it's interesting, you know, that not even just the gender roles of the hero, but the gender roles that they hit on with the villain. And it wasn't like Elastigirl was up against some scary man, you know, because even in some of the where you're starting to see more, you know, more female leads, there are times where the villain is still, you know, the man or, you know, a giant alien guy with a gauntlet fist. I mean, even when you've got strong female characters. So this I found was really intriguing because it also touched on the nature of what I, you know, what I found of like female friendships. And that Evelyn was speaking into a part of Elastigirl, of Helen, that she had probably, you know, kept to herself and started to, what you think is encouraging her, but is kind of digging into those little gaps and those little holes. And I just thought that was very interesting because it wasn't a blatant villain. I mean, I feel like in the first one, Syndrome, it becomes so obvious from the beginning. You know, he's got his own powers that he's created through technology. And once again, we're having that conversation with technology, but it's a more nuanced, subtle flip almost on the traditional villain in the superhero movie. So I think that was very intentional, and it was very well done. I mean, my 10-year-old picked up on that, and she thought it was neat how Evelyn was playing both sides without it being obvious. So, you know, neat as in that, I guess, that she pulled it off for so long in the film and she didn't see it coming. But I think that's something to kind of keep in mind, too, as we continue to talk about it and this film continues to grow in its audience and see how it stands that test of time as to how those roles interact with one another from, you know, the superhero villain aspect.
One question I've been thinking about recently is, you know, are we pushing the female aspect of, like, too far in this day and age? I mean, not in a bad way.
Oh, this is going to be good, Heather. Let's watch him backpedal on this one. This is going to be really entertaining. Go ahead, Alan.
I'm totally okay. Open. That's what film is supposed to do, help facilitate these conversations. So I trust Alan. I trust him.
Good. I trust you guys. Now, what I mean by this is a lot of the films we've been seeing as of late have had more of more of a female slant to them. You know, The Miracle Season, there was a lot of that. Even A Wrinkle in Time, it was mainly a female cast. They actually put Zach Galifianakis in it because the happy medium was supposed to be a woman as well, but they wanted a little more gender balance.
That's an undervalued film too, but we won't go into that.
Hey, I liked it.
I mean, it was life-changing in our household, so.
was wonderful. And I love Wrinkle in Time. It's one of my top five books of all time. So, but yeah, I just think the role reversal, it's almost like maybe I think we're talking about it too much. It's not a bad thing. It's just maybe we're trying to push his agenda a little bit too much to the detriment of, you know, a lot of other things that are going on that maybe need more discussion.
And I think that's a valid point, because when it comes down to it, you can push something far enough to where the story suffers. And yes, if the story suffers and if the topic suffers, are we really doing the right thing? And I think, though, that's something, at least with Incredibles 2, is it felt like a more natural conversation was happening.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel that anything was being forced. And I think it was because of the way they were still integrating the entire storyline of Bob at home, of, you know, Frozone still being there, the brother and sister dynamic of Evelyn.
Winston.
Yes. And so I the good thing is I didn't feel that like being forced upon me or my kids or the theater as a whole. It felt like I wanted to know more about Elastigirl anyway, because we know what made Bob tick. We knew what made Mr. Incredible Mr. Incredible. We didn't get that same, you know, history into Elastigirl. And I think it was kind of nice to see her in that spotlight, to how they complement each other and literally what it means to be both strong and flexible, which I think is a model for families as they're watching this movie, is why you need both attributes to raise a healthy family.
Ha, flexible. I heard what you did there.
Oh, good. Yes.
I said flexible. You know.
I kept thinking about Void. She was one of the new characters that was somehow able to make these magic halo-like portals everywhere. But yet you saw all the inferiority and uncertainty in her life. At one point, she actually went up to Elastigirl and said, "How do you balance superhero stuff with the life stuff?" And you didn't really get a good answer immediately from Elastigirl, but you did get to see that portrayed, you know, through the life of Bob and such.
Yeah, I want to address when you guys talked about female leads as well. I think, first of all, Void as well is she was the one character that we came out of there, my boys and I. We said she was, other than Jack-Jack, she was our favorite one in the film. One of the things that really I thought was interesting in this particular story, and I think Heather, you're right when you talk about the exploration of gender roles, is that even both films, the first one and the second one, balances out the figures. Now, she's at home in the first film, but she has lots to do. She's not just at home. Like, she is very actively involved, so there's still focus on the whole family. And they do that well here, so they can flip it around and have them both characters learn new things without changing what they've already set up, which is really about them as a family. But, you know, it's interesting when you talk about the conversation on a cultural level. One of the things we've seen, and I think it worked in this film, one of the things we've seen, I think, is when people have the biggest complaints, because fanboys are driving me nuts. They're killing me. They're killing me. One of the big complaints about the new Star Wars trilogy is that it's a female lead, and, oh, this is agenda pushing. They rebooted Ghostbusters with girls, gasp, female characters, and which, this is sacrilege, I realize, but I actually like that film better than the original. All of our listeners have stopped listening just because I said that. but I mean, it's interesting that one of the things you see is when you give strong stories to female leads, people buy in. When you take a character and you just make it a female lead, that's when people sort of react strongly. So, for example, Luke Skywalker was always the focus. The Skywalker family was always the focus in the Star Wars films. And then now it's this girl, but she's not Luke, and Luke's not the way I wanted him to be. And people react because that's not the story they had in their head. But I think it was Alan, you mentioned about going too far in one direction. I think you have to get to balance it out. At first, you have to be willing to say, we're going to do this We're going to have multiple films telling this story, or not this story, but try and bring some voice when there hasn't been any. And I think that's what you see.
But how far do you take it before it balances back to the norm?
That's a more difficult question to answer, but I think if you don't, then it's more difficult to swing it back into the norm. And I think you look at a film like Incredibles 2, not The Incredibles 2, because they've dropped the definite article. But in Incredibles 2, you see more balance in a lot of ways. And the other thing to think of, too, in this film is time. These films are set really in a – they never say it, but it's set in an idealized, like, mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
So those sorts of gender and even racial biases, although they never explore the racial bias in these particular films, I've noticed. They've never explored those yet. But those things exist in that subculture at that time. The only date they ever give is in the first film. They say it was like 1958 when the first lawsuit happened. And I think they say it's like 12 years later or something like that at one point. And it's like late 60s, early 70s. But it sort of got that classic feel, which I think is important when you're having this conversation, because it's trying to sort of hold up the quote-unquote traditional values and shed new light on them. I would argue. I don't know what you guys think, but it's one of the things I see.
Well, and that's really interesting, too, because not even just the gender roles or bias, or, you know, where they haven't explored the racial bias, but, I mean, honestly, I think, at least with both films, there's this tension between what the supers can do naturally and what is created technologically.
Yeah.
And you see that with Syndrome, and you see that with Evelyn and the screen slaver, and spoiler alert, oh gosh, do we need to say spoiler alert?
Oh yeah, I usually say that there's there's spoilers. Go ahead.
Okay.
Let me just spoil it.
But I think that's an interesting thing too, because it's not even just the tensions between people and the supers and the nons, you know, the way X-Men has been in the past, if, you know, for a comparison of
right.
those who have power and those who don't, or powers, but the tension between the supers and their powers and technology, and the technology that can be designed to fight them, but also how in that process, you know, the damage that can be done. So it's interesting to, I didn't know that it was set in that kind of time frame, you know, whether it's unspoken or just hinted at. So that to me is even more interesting, because we're kind of toying with an intergenerational tension almost,
yeah.
of what is coming towards us and what we have experienced in the past. And I think that's part of the Parr family too, and what they're working towards together is, you know, they've had their experiences, and Bob and Helen have this conversation, and where Bob is like, you have to do this to give them the choice later so that they can decide. So I think that is kind of all coming together, the way that these two movies were set, you know, back to back plot wise.
Yeah.
And not skipping anything, because those moments are, you know, one follows the other, they're consecutive. And at the same time, there's all these different, you know, like Jack exploring different dimensions. There's so many dimensions, I think, that goes on that we can find ourselves in without even realizing it.
Well, there is another clue about time frame. At one point, Dash turns on the TV and is watching an episode of Johnny Quest, which came out in 1964. So to say that that's within that time frame is absolutely perfect.
Well, and this is the funny thing about using Screenslaver as a villain. How many tablets did you see? None. There's no tablets. None. There's no cell phones.
Oh my goodness, you totally just messed with my whole brain.
She goes on, or he, I have to say this too. I could not draw a line between Evelyn's motivation and the Screenslaver motivation. I just couldn't figure out how they were connected. Because Screenslaver is all about tech. He's all about, or she, he, it is all about tech. And she is a techie person, but it doesn't seem to be an issue for her. She doesn't have any concerns about that. It's more about who's in the front seat. But, like, Screenslaver makes some pretty good points. I'm not going to lie. What is superheroes are part of your desire to substitute real experiences with shows. You don't play games, you watch game shows. You're ever the ravenous consumers. He says, It's pretty profound stuff. That one really long speech he makes is actually pretty good. But the technology is not where it is today. It was really interesting to me.
And yet at the same time, Evelyn later on says, you know, people will trade quality for ease every time. And so that makes me think, you know, oh, yeah, we're going to sit back. We're going to watch the show and just let it wash over us, not caring what it is.
Yeah, I think I get where Alan might be going, you know, if I can project his future thoughts. But, you know, I think, too, with Evelyn and connecting her motivation with the screenslaver is, I think it's an example of how we can take something that is designed to benefit, but when there is an intention or a motivation behind it that is less than nice. I mean, Evelyn, I think there's this really unexplored dimension to her of grief and revenge, and her parents depending on something that they couldn't see or have access to, but was very much real to them, but not real enough to save their lives. And I think that's part of what this story is exploring in the screenslaver, you know, forcing a reality that isn't the truth and is just happens to be using technology to do that. I mean, I think it could be, it's a universal, if I may be so bold, you know, concern that it, whether it was through the technology or through the conversations that she was having with Helen, the hints were there that this was a, you know, a skewing of and a distortion of the reality, and the tech just happened to be the tool. At least that's how I was viewing it, and kind of connecting what was actually happening versus what the supers and those enslaved witnessed to be happening.
And then you have another role reversal here, which you'd mentioned we've been talking about already. You know, what does it say that the kids have to set the parents free? They have to break away from screens. Whereas, you know, deep down right now, if you give a kid a screen, you pretty much got them entranced.
Well, yeah, and do the kids ever even get a screen? They don't even get the glasses on, do they?
No, they never get the glasses on.
The only time
Jack makes it figure out, yeah.
The only time the kids watch a screen is when Jack won't go to bed because he's watching TV.
Yes.
And they're watching Johnny Quest. When they're, yes. They're, those times they are watching. I don't think
or
Violet
they're watching
ever
a screen in order to track Jack, but I guess that's different. That's more like a GPS.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I need one of those for our boss baby. She needs one.
That darn raccoon.
That was great. Oh, my gosh. My 7-year-old was Jeremiah was dying. It was so funny.
That's the first time and the only time I will ever feel bad for a raccoon. vicious beasts they are. They got what they deserved. To roll back a little bit, I think, Alan, that's a good point. But one of the things that Heather mentioned that caught my attention is the idea of getting your perceptions based on what you get from tech, which, you know, is obviously a current throw to the fake news stuff. But they actually say that in the film, because what's the problem with superheroes? It's perception. It's not about the screens per se, except that it is, if that makes any sense, because what Winston says is that all they see is the destruction. They didn't see how it got there. So the problem with the super is that's why he gives them the cameras in their suits, so they get the whole story. Because all they ever see in the news coverage is the devastation that's left afterwards, and they can't do anything. The public are making their decision on the supers based on the end result, which is interesting, because it does play into this idea of screens determining reality. Even if the screenslaver is talking about how screens are delaying us from how we actually live, which is actually feels like a throwback to WALL-E. They flat out tell you that the media is skewing the actual full events because of one aspect of it. I thought that was particularly interesting.
Yeah, I feel like I really need to like sit on that now, and we need a part two.
Yeah.
Okay, 14 years from now, we'll come back with the follow-up episode.
Oh my.
And we'll pick it up right where we left off.
I mean, with technology, it'll just come up on Facebook. You know, 14 years ago on this day, you posted this podcast.
Oh, my gosh. We're still going to be on Facebook 14 years from now?
Those of us who are on, you know, quote unquote, traditional social media that happened to be in college when it first came out and you had to be in college and your college had to be on it before you could get it. Those of us might still be on there. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Fair enough. What did you guys think of the kids in this particular film? That's one of the things we haven't talked about very much, is not just the fact that they're relatable, but their role in the story. Was there anything that caught your attention about that?
Well, for me, each of the kids had their own unique set of problems and struggles. Dash having problems with his class and his math, and it was pushed him to the point where he was falling asleep doing his homework. You've got Violet all in arrears and just having girl issues with Tony, and then all mad at her dad, and you know, it's, you know, typical teenage stuff. And then her dad decides to, you know, probably in the funniest part of the movie for me, when he tries to set her up with Tony, and Tony doesn't know who she is, and then she squirts water out of her nose. I literally did not stop laughing for about 10 seconds. It was great. And yet, Jack, you know, okay, well, what is this person? How do you help people who are just trying to figure out who they are in real life? And I think that's what, you know, Bob was trying to do when he was actually awake, because he was so exhausted from trying to figure out the answers to the other two kids' problems. So we had to bring, the kids had to call intervention, they bring Frozone into the situation, and at least they know, you know, we have problems. How are we going to get them solved? Let's think about this and let's try to solve a problem, especially when our dad doesn't know left from right. And that brings up another question. You know, this isn't a film that really is, you know, oh yeah, dad's the dumb dad and, you know, everything like that. He may be at first, or it seems like it, but he gets smarter. He starts picking things up later. And I think I appreciated that a lot in Incredibles 2.
Yeah, that was one of the things I liked about it, is I didn't get the sense that anybody was dumb or inferior in this one. They're all working out their issues. But one of the things I liked was the idea of generational conversation. That was one thing that struck me. Even the idea of math changing, you know, especially with Bob trying to work out talking with Violet and with Dash, he simply just doesn't get it. Because in his mind, what he's trying to do is the right thing. He just doesn't understand how to do it. And I don't mean in a way that is foolhardy. I just mean that he doesn't know how that he's trying to learn how they think. And I just saw a movie this week, Eighth Grade by Bo Burnham. And we'll have a review later on in the month when the movie comes out. But that movie really, this has been on my mind a lot, because that movie really explores this idea of what it means to talk and listen to one another. And I got the sense that Bob was trying to learn how to do it. And again, going back to time, I thought that that was sort of a new idea for that particular time. It was one of the things I really appreciated about the film, is it really sort of took that seriously.
Well, and kind of along those lines, you know, earlier you had mentioned that you didn't, you know, that Edna was a little bit, I guess, more of a minor character this time than she was last time. And yet, I feel like without her role already established for us, it would not have worked another way to get to know Jack, because you don't need to see all of the, you know, each power or each moment where he's changing. It just needed somebody to kind of go through that with him off camera. And I think the reason that struck me so much is, you know, that idea of, once again, coming back to our perception and what we're seeing, you know, often when we are so engrossed and so close to something, it is very difficult to step back and see what is actually happening. And Edna was able to be that, you know, that outside objective perspective, and was able to not just bond with Jack and get to know him and help him find the manifestations of his identity with, you know, however many options he has, but to do so in a way that was effective storytelling that could be trusted, because we've already established Edna as a trusted character, but also at the same time as somebody who's surprising. She's not a baby person. You know, she lets that She makes that very clear at the beginning, but the minute she sees what he's going through, there's another part of her that connects with him, and she's able to kind of navigate that with him for, you know, as she put 17, I think it was 17 hours was how long Bob slept, and so that's how long she had had Jack-Jack. And again, I think it is playing with our how close we are to things, and also how close, you know, when we are connected with people. And I think that is kind of a there's so many subtleties for me in this movie that as we're having this conversation, mm-hmm. you know, they're hitting me more and more. But, you know, kind of Edna being that unspoken person who may not have any baby experience, but she's got super experience. Mm-hmm. And she's able to use that twofold because she's removed from the day to day with him. And I could probably articulate it better if I think about it a little bit more, but that started to kind of just resonate with me is that those, you know, kind of seemingly small connections that we have in our lives that turn out to be some of the most important ones we have. Mm. Not necessarily throughout our entire life, but at those pivotal moments. Mm. And I think, you know, Elastigirl was becoming that for Void in those few interactions that we got. You know, Void was able to see in somebody in front of her that embodied what she was looking for, and start to build that for her. So we got to see it there. We got to see it Edna and Jack-Jack, and Edna kind of helping, you know, him figure out who he is, and also then inform Bob how to manage him. But also Bob, you know, taking the time to learn the math and connect with Dash on that level. I mean, I have sat and had my daughter teach me math a new way. Like, that has happened to me in real life. Hmm. And those little connections and those little moments, I think, are, again, what makes this story such a good story.
I think Helen actually says to Bob at one point, when talking about the kids, actually says they haven't decided what they are. And I think that that sort of relationship and walking them through that process, you know, whether it's parents to kids to mentoring with someone like Void, I think you're right. There's sort of those moments that sort of highlight walking with them, walking like generational conversation and together, which I think is really unique and special. I think that's a very positive thing about the film.
Yeah. And too, and I think again, it comes into, you know, something that resonates, I guess, where we are now, and not just for me as a parent, but just in general as a fellow human being in the current environment that we're in right now with society, is that idea of creating something and making, whether it is a law or, you know, the opportunities, making sure they're there so that the next generation can make their own decisions and not be, you know, coerced into them because there aren't any other options. So that idea of creating options and the importance of doing that from one generation to the next, I think ties really nicely into what you just said. Mm.
Well, helping them, you know, deal with these situations, that's critical. I mean, for parents, you know, wherever you're at. One of the things I thought about was, you know, Vi, when she eventually she renounced her calling of being a super. And then the question, you know, how do we come back from, you know, those times when we, you know we have to be doing something, and then we just go, I can't do this anymore. This is not me. But yet it is you, and we have those people that walk beside us, sort of like Elastigirl was doing with Void, to bring us to a place where we can remember who we were again. Did we want to talk about the fact, you know, that Evelyn was saved by Elastigirl and yet at the same time didn't want to be saved because she kicked her in the face, and yet Elastigirl held on to her and made sure she was safe and didn't drown?
I hadn't made that connection. This is the first time I've considered it.
Well, the thing is this, you know, Evelyn obviously did not deserve to be, in essence, in this case, saved. Kind of like we are as, you know, simple human beings. And B, she didn't want it. Elastigirl finally captures her and she smacks her or punches her in the face one. And yet, sometimes I feel like we do that, you know, with God. You know, okay, I don't really want what you are giving me, but you're going to give it to me anyway? Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm still not clear on why she didn't want to be rescued. Because you're right, she does refuse it. Now, is that her trying to get away?
Could be.
Because she doesn't have a death wish by any stretch. I never got that from her character.
I thought maybe she was just more committed to proving her point. You know, there's the interaction where she said something about, you know, the biggest difference between you and me is your core values. And Elastigirl responds back with, at least I have some, or at least, you know, at least I have them. And I think for Evelyn, it was almost more of her drive to sell, to pull off what Winston does, you know, to sell her point to the masses that she's right. I think it was less about, you know, I think living clearly, but I think it was more of whether Elastigirl, no matter what Elastigirl had done, Evelyn's point was still there, I think, and was still made. You know, she had gotten out there and had, you know, put it into Elastigirl's mind that basically, you know, like it's been mentioned, you're still making people weak. It's not about you. You know, people are going to choose ease over quality, you know, to pull back some of those quotes. I think it was just more of she, in her mind, I think there was an element of winning that had already happened. And I think Violet and Void touch on that when they're like, she's rich. How much time is she really going to serve? And I think that is what was irritating, because I think we see that every day is people, you know, when we look at, you know, to use some buzzwords, if we look at things like justice and retribution and guilt, we have an expectation of what somebody should experience based on their actions. And for me, Elastigirl's focus wasn't on the retribution aspect. Elastigirl's focus was she protected the others from what Evelyn was doing and then kind of left it be and went right back to what needed her attention at that moment. And that was, you know, her realizing Jack-Jack's powers and things like that. So I think that is something to kind of meditate on and to think about is, you know, when we help, I don't know if it's help or, you know, but when we see something wrong, when we see something that, you know, morally is not sitting well with us, not just how do we respond and make sure it's right in that moment, but then how do we go back to doing what we were doing? And I think that's something that, you know, now that Alan, you kind of like said that out loud, as far as, you know, Evelyn not wanting to get saved, so to speak, I think I might have to, you know, kind of think on that some more too.
I think in that particular moment, Elastigirl shows greater strength of character than Mr. Incredible. Because in the first film, going back to the first film, after he thinks that the family is lost or dead, he threatens to kill Mirage. He has his arms around her throat, and he's trying to bluff Syndrome into just, you know, into, I forget what the issue is. But whatever he's trying to bluff Syndrome into, he's trying to say, you know, I will do this. He actually says it'll be easy, like snapping a toothpick. And Mirage actually calls Syndrome out later for it. And he says, it was going to be fine. And can you tell we just watched the movie like twice before we went on? My kids just kept putting it on. But it's like there was a greater strength of character there to me in Elastigirl, who never considers compromising. You know, she doesn't take the Batman route saying, you know, I don't have to kill you, but I don't have to save you. She's committed to that moment. And yeah, you're right. I hadn't thought of it that way either, Heather, because she then goes back to the things that are more important to her. That's interesting. She snaps right back and doesn't get wrapped up in that. And that happens. I mean, go ahead.
Also turn that into work-life balance, you know, leaving work at work and going back to home when you're at home. But that might be the corporate speak in me.
No, I think that's fair because earlier in the film, she does that. There's a couple of times when the kids try to get her attention while she's at work and she's just, you know, leave me alone. Like when she's running down the train and Dash calls about, I forget it is, like something that he's got. Yeah, something like that. And there's another moment as well where I sort of went, oh, that was kind of abrupt. But at the end of the film, she manages to put the focus back where it needs to be. That's interesting. I hadn't thought of it from that angle.
And to not withhold good from those who deserve it when it's in your power to act. Proverbs 3:27.
Drop the mic.
Well, maybe that's a good place for us to wrap up here. Heather, Alan, let's do Screen It or Skip It. Incredibles 2, Screen It or Skip It.
All right, Heather, you go first.
Okay, I'll go first. It's definitely a Screen It. I don't get to actual movie theater movies very often, and this was worth every moment.
I would also say Screen It. There are so many lessons that you can get out of the film, but what's even more impressive to me is the fact of the lessons that your kids will get out of the film when they walk out of the theater, and they can carry on through the various courses of their lives, being examples to the adults, you know, that a family's a team, no man's an island. I could keep going, but definitely Screen It.
Just to upset people, I'm not going to say Skip It because I don't think you should skip it, but I do think you can wait for Blu-ray. So stream it, I guess.
Nice third option.
Thanks.
Ooh.
It has shown up before. I do feel like if you go to the theater, you're going to enjoy it. I do feel like it is worth your time and money. But I also feel like if you want to watch this at home, you can do that. And I don't have a problem with that. Sometimes I feel like you have to be there to watch it in the grand scale. I don't feel like you need that with this movie, although it's a great film. I have no... I fall somewhere between the two, but yeah, it's pretty solid. It's well written. I'm not taking anything away from it, but
just for that, the underminer is going to come and get you.
He's beneath all of us, but nothing is beneath him. I love that line anyway.
I like the theme songs too, but that was just me.
I you know what, Alan, we're going to get you your own theme song just because of that.
But no capes.
No capes. No capes.
No capes.
Y'all, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a lot of fun, and I really appreciate it. And it was great having you both on. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Anytime. Thank you.
And for those of you at home, a reminder that you can find us pretty much anywhere where podcasts are. Google Play, iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, Hufflepuff, Piggly Pie, Sasquatch, all of those. I hope those aren't real sites, actually, those last three, because somebody's going to be like, well, I looked for them on Sasquatch. I couldn't find them.
Hufflepuff? I mean, of all the Harry Potter houses, you say Hufflepuff?
What? Would you rather we were live on Slytherin? Like, come on.
Ravenclaw, come on.
If you go to our podcast page on screenfish.net, our website, you can download Fishing for More, some small group questions to set you up if you do see the film with others. And I'm sure that you either already have or will, because it's a pretty solid film. And stay tuned. We will be back on our next episode on Jurassic World. Still working on a time frame. Hopefully that'll be within 2 weeks. And also look for our first ever episode. Well, I guess I can't say it's our first ever episode because we did the Marvel podcast earlier on this year. But the group of teens that started off with the Marvel podcast is coming back with their own podcast on Ant-Man and the Wasp. And so look for that as well over the next few weeks. That might even be within the next week. I'm not quite sure when they're recording, but that'll be soon. Anyway, thank you guys so much for being on. Loved our conversation. And for those of you at home, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.
Behold, the Underminer.
I tend to dream about dinosaurs a lot. Like, I've had a tea party with the Indominus Rex. I'm not lying. not even.
What?
And Chris Pratt was there, so it was all Jurassic World having a tea party. I'm not kidding.
That's.
I keep thinking Meet the Robinsons and the T-Rex that has big head and little arms.
No, I haven't had that one yet.
You will tonight now. Wait.
I will tonight now, though. Thank you.
Yeah, and instead of Chris Pratt, it'll be Alan.
Yeah, this the Stevosaur.
Oh man, I'm the dinosaur. Oh geez. The youth call me old, but I don't think I was there yet.